Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 1100.2T0316, certificate number 24503, the Sana'a manuscript.
So one might think that having done the Sarajevo Haggadah, that I was
Sarajevo Haggadah. What a wonderful phrase.
Sarajevo Haggadah.
Ain't no cellar passing door. Craze. Yeah, so equal time, right?
Well, that's the thing. You might think that having done it, I didn't want to be, outdone. And now I was going to bring my own ancient manuscript. But in fact...
Because you've discovered Allah. A lot of people don't know what happened to you in prison, John. Mm-hmm. You want to walk us through that?
Mm-hmm. It was... I kind of went down a Turkish rabbit hole, literally.
No, it wasn't a Turkish prison. You were, you were just somewhere you were feeling bad about your misspent youth. A bald cellmate with a little kind of pillbox hat hands you a book, and your life has changed.
Somebody started reciting the Quran to me in Arabic. And although I don't speak Arabic, I did find the rhythm of the night soothing. And that is how I began my journey.
You're in Islam for the vibes.
Well, interesting. So anyway, I just wanted to clarify. One might think I was doing this in response to your ancient manuscript show, but in fact, I completely forgot that you had done an ancient manuscript show and just woke up the other day and was like, that Sana'a manuscript, I'm not going to say Sana'a. I'm just going to say Sana'a.
I mean, I probably said it wrong. It doesn't have a little Hawaiian glottal stop in it.
All of the pronunciations on this show are going to be wrong. And
that will help people. It'll help people narrow down what the right pronunciation is. Because if we say it a few ways, they'll know those are all wrong.
Yeah, that's right. All of my English pronunciations are wrong. So why should my Arabic pronunciations be better?
Well, because you're
trying? No.
No. It's because you're not dishonoring Allah when you say something wrong in English.
There you go.
When you say something wrong that's Quranic.
Well, hopefully I won't be saying any Quranic things today.
Because you haven't been smoking any of that sweet Quranic?
I won't. That's not how we pronounce it.
It's not three syllables?
Quranic.
That dank Quranic.
No. The Arabic language is a big part of the story.
Uh-huh.
Because, as you may know, the Quran is an Arabic document, an Arabic poem, an Arabic revelation.
And isn't there like theological implications to that? Like, I have an English version of the Quran in my house, but that's not the real Quran, right? That's like fanfic.
Well,
because if you're Muslim, you don't think it can be translated.
Well, it can be translated.
Okay.
It's just not the authentic revelation outside of Arabic. It is in Arabic, and everything that isn't the Quran in Arabic is an interpretation of it.
If I translate the Quran into some other language, I basically made a study aid.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
But it's not the way we would say, I got the Bible over here in French, Korean, and Tagalog.
That's the thing. We talk about the Bible as a document the King James Version is the one that was most prominently used in Western Christianity until the Extreme Teen Bible came out in 1997.
That changed my life.
And now that's the definitive document. But, the original Bible was written, or the New Testament was written in Greek. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, but when the Old Testament was originally translated into Latin, it was translated first from Greek. So the Hebrew Bible had been translated into Greek to make it more current and cool.
It's the extreme teen Bible of its time.
It was. And so, the Bible was translated into Latin first by St. Jerome, and that was almost in 400 AD.
The Vulgate.
Before that, you know, the Bible in Greek, the Hebrew Bible translated into Greek was called the Septuagint.
Right.
And so even the Latin Bible was a combination of various texts. In fact, the Greek that the New Testament was written in was not even classical Greek. It was vernacular Greek. And the sort of original Greek scholars were like, what is this trash?
It's like Koine Greek or something.
Yeah, it's just like street Greek.
It's the extreme teen Bible again.
It again.
At every point in history.
And so what we think of, and the people in the United States or fundamentalist Christians everywhere who point to the Bible and call it the unerring word of God or God's, a document that shall not be trifled with. You know, they're talking about a book that's been...
It's been nothing but trifled with.
And the original Hebrew didn't even have vowels. So there were a lot of interpretations just of the text as it was written. You know, you could, based on a pronunciation that wasn't made clear in the book, the word could have two different meanings.
Let's bring that back. The Wheel of Fortune Bible. It's all consonants. In the beginning, good created.
I love that you just right out of nowhere just started reciting a Bible with no vowels.
I think
well
it would.
Done. How far could you go? Do you think
the heaven and the earth? I mean, earth is pronounced the same with or without vowels. We need more words like that in the Wheel of Fortune Bible.
The Quran, by comparison, is in Arabic, and it is an Arabic revelation, and only can be fully appreciated and understood as spoken in the Arabic language.
Does this mean a lot of Muslims worldwide will try to pick up some Arabic to get a better glimpse into the Quran?
Absolutely. So, you know, Indonesia is the most populous Muslim nation. And Indonesia actually has a small population of people descended from Arabs who arrived there as traders kind of in the initial era of, I mean, I guess probably pre-Islam, there were Arab traders in Indonesia. So now there are...
They just came for the puppet theater. They're like, we're going to cross the Indian Ocean. There better be something good over there.
Puppet theater, and then...
And there was.
And that cool
gamelan music. Yeah, exactly. That's Spinal Tap.
So this actually comes up in Indonesia a lot because everyone learns the Quran as they learn it as a spoken document in Arabic, and with
gloss. Like, do they know what they're saying?
Well, the argument for translations of the Quran are just what you would expect, just like the medieval argument for translations of the Bible from Latin into vernacular language, English, French, etc., which was heretical until the era right around the Reformation. People were burned at the stake for translating the Bible into French.
I think we should continue that.
Burning people at the stake is really underrated.
Well, I'm not into burning them. I just think nobody should be translating the Bible into French. What kind of weirdo today would be translating the Bible into French? Like, that person is not a productive member of society. Let's burn them at the stake.
Yeah, hey, you're not St. Jerome. That work's been done.
But plus, Joan of Arc is, you know, the greatest French heroine, and she burned at the stake, so it's...
So what's so bad about it?
They would probably they would love it. They'll be like, I'm going to be on a postage stamp someday.
If you were going to be killed in France for heresy, would you rather be burned at the stake for religious heresy or guillotined for political heresy?
Is there like culinary heresy?
What would that be?
Like, you know, you put the wrong kind of sauce on a piece of fish, and they're like, Zutalor, send him away.
Is that what you expect to be most guilty of?
Yeah. That,
culinary
that's
heresy?
A more likely, you know, it's just, I'll be an American at some restaurant, and I'll be like, they'll serve me mayo with my fries, and I'll be like, hey, can I have some ketchup over here? And they'll be like, no.
In my case, I think it would be mistranslating the language of love.
Romantic heresy.
No, that is not how it is done. Hey, I'm a Western American. I can do what
do
I
do you
want.
Feel like the French dispatch referees to hotel rooms to make sure they listen. The art of love is being...
They listen with a cup on the door.
Held up to French standards. They bust right in. No, this position. You cannot try it here.
You're going too fast.
We have gone far beyond this.
No, but seriously.
We've gone far afield from the Quran, and there's probably a fatwa against us right now.
The argument for translating the Quran is, if this is a guide to living, which the Quran is, and tens of millions of people who follow it as a guide do not understand it, how is it working as a guide?
I mean, that's the status of the Bible in America today. Tens of millions of people claim to follow it. No idea what's in it.
And so there, you know, contrary, I think, to a lot of people's understanding, there is no fatwa against translating the Quran. It is just not the definitive...
It's no longer the Quran.
It's only a study guide, as you're saying.
Got it.
And a lot of Indonesians do learn Arabic in terms of the Quran and can recite the Quran. And not just to single out Indonesians. There are, you know, millions of people around the world who are Muslim who aren't fluent in Arabic.
But shout out to the Indonesians.
They're just a lot. By the numbers, tens of millions of Indonesians. And this is a conversation that happens in Indonesia between people that are like, why do we have to listen to it in? I mean, no, I don't think anybody complains.
No, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't be like, I want the Quran in Bahasa, because, you know, somebody at the mosque will give them a stern talking to.
In Arabic,
exactly.
The idea of hearing the Quran in Arabic is that because this was God's intention that you hear it this way, even not understanding it, just the recitation of it is not just soothing, but
something is conveyed.
That's right. It is
something
true,
of God's will,
and you are experiencing a closeness to God in hearing it. And memorizing the Quran is a big part of the study of it. And
wow,
there are millions and millions of people who can recite the Quran all the way through,
just front to back.
Front to back.
And it's do I have the right idea here? It's roughly Bible-like length.
I mean, you've got a translation of it.
Apparently, I haven't delved. It was actually sent to me by a Muslim Jeopardy fan. Who thought, like, when
thought you didn't know enough about
saw
it.
Me on the show and was like, you know who needs the good word is this Opie looking kid.
I have a couple of English Qurans, or rather study guides that claim
copies
to be
of the Quran.
The Quran. And I was carrying one when I was in the West Bank, and I was
just like as a
just like, leave me alone, don't shoot. No. No, I just had I had it in the car. I was carrying it as part of just my travels through the, you know,
as you often do.
You kind of want to look stuff up periodically, and weirdly, I was driving around Hebron and then kind of just was following my bliss and ended up in Bethlehem and was just driving around, kind of just no map.
It's really remarkable you're here today.
No, it's just kind of the, you know, I don't use map programs on my phone even in the States. So, I mean, I guess that's
you don't
not...
Want, you don't want the man telling you what to do.
That's not a reason not to do it other places.
In Hebron.
But, you know, they're really into the program Waze over there.
Oh, interesting.
Everywhere you go, they're like, oh, you got to use Waze. And...
Is it because they think God moves in mysterious ways?
Hang on. Where's my bell? It was over here. Now I'm going to get it.
You need like a shofar or a call to prayer, a muezzin.
No, I can't do them.
In fact, you probably shouldn't. In fact, like, that's maybe that was offensive just now.
you know, I'm treading it, but the problem is we talk about religion all the time on this show. So if we tread upon one, tread upon all, I say. Oh, but anyway, so
I offend everyone equally. You're a YouTube comedian now. You're gonna have a new record called. You know, they all have the word canceled in them or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, that's right. That's what comedy is. But so I was driving along and all of a sudden, you know, I'm stuck in traffic. And, you know, anybody who's been to Hebron is going to go, what? Are you kidding? Stuck in traffic. And so I'm inching along in traffic. And then I look up and I have completely by accident come to a border crossing through the wall. Into
which way?
I'm headed out of the West Bank and into the Israeli side. Mm-hmm. And I had not intended to go across, but there was no way for me to turn around. And so I'm sitting in traffic and this guy comes over and knocks on the window and he's selling little cups of very bad coffee in plastic cups. And I was like, I don't have any money. I'm just over here driving around and there's nothing I can.
Did the conversation work? He had a little English?
Or? Oh, and when we had a little French between us. And,
nice.
And he was like, well, you know, come on, buy something. Like I got mouths to feed. And I was like, I honestly don't have any money. What can I do? I'm not going to give you my glasses. And he was like, all right, well here, have a cup of coffee on me. And I was like, wow, thank you. And he was like, you know, welcome to Palestine.
Hospitality.
And I said, you know what? I'm going to give you my English Quran. And he was kind of astonished by it.
That you had it?
A, you have one. And right. B, this. And he looked at it like, this is in English? It's Quran, but it's in English? And I was like, it is. And we didn't have enough time because then I was going across the border to a place that he was not allowed to go. But I did have that cultural exchange where I was handing him the definitive study guide in English. And who knows where that is now?
It's the ultimate omnibus moment. You briefly had an exchange with a Muslim man and tried to explain Islam to him.
After I left, I thought, I bet 100% that he sold that to a German within 2 hours.
The German's like, I got this rare Palestinian copy of an English Quran.
Exactly. Who knows? Coffee stains.
Who knows how it got there?
So the fact that the Quran is in Arabic and that is the definitive Quran really plays into this whole story, especially the idea that there is a definitive Quran.
Mm-hmm.
The Quran was given to Muhammad as a series of inspirations, right? The angel Gabriel appeared to him in a cave.
Jibril.
We call him. Who calls him
that? That was his street name at the time in Saudi Jibril. Arabia.
Hey.
Yeah, he's Gabriel when he shows up in Bethlehem
or
Nazareth or whatever. He's Jibril when
he shows up. He's Jibril here in the cave.
That's kind of his cave name. Gabriel's his government name.
You know what? Gabriel is my father's name. Call me Gabriel. A lot of scholarship kind of differs because there's some question about what some of these words actually mean, even in the time, because Arabic script, even then, also kind of lacked. Both vowels, but especially diacritical marks that would allow you to know how exactly to pronounce some of these words that without diacriticals. The consonants have different, you could pronounce them different right. ways.
Are they like proper names or is it like we can't even tell which of these two Arabic words is meant here?
Yeah. There's the question of which Arabic word this spelling could represent. And often in context, it kind of could be either. It changes the meaning of, and I'm not talking specifically about the Quran, but
all
just
writing in that period.
Writing in general. But there are a lot of sources that say Muhammad was not literate. He did not write it down. It was given to him as an inspiration and he came out and recited it.
And so a scribe would have written it.
Well, in those very early days, a scribe would not have written it. His immediate followers, his first little cadre of bros, Abu Bakr was his father-in-law and was one of his, his first companion.
I mean, that's nice that your father-in-law is your first convert. I mean, it really says something for their family and also for the value of the message, because father-in-laws are going to be very skeptical of their son-in-law coming to them with like,
Guess
I got this new investment idea for you. Starting up a new venture. It's called Islam.
And part of what's amazing about the story of the Quran is that it was a spoken testimony, a spoken, recited, sung kind of epic poem. And I keep saying poem, and I don't know within Islam whether they would describe it as a poem, but you know, I think that way about all spoken tradition. Like it has
literary devices for sure. Yeah.
That the text of it has remained so consistent from its very earliest iteration strikes me as incredible to go into a cave and have, whether Gabriel is speaking through you or not, to come out and be able to recite these chapters or surah of the book kind of verbatim multiple times
at length,
enough for your followers to then memorize those surah. It speaks to the unfathomableness of Muhammad's inspiration.
Right. What kind of religious imagination would it take to do that?
Yeah. Like if I were sitting and coming up with a new Bible, I don't know if I would be able to stick to the text.
Can you imagine the podcast version of this? Every week I'm going to release 8 new chapters of my scriptural work off the top of my head.
You know, Gabriel did not appear to Muhammad until he was 40 years old.
Until Gabriel was 40 years
until
old.
Until Gabriel was
until
40.
Until Muhammad was 40 years old.
Got until it. Muhammad was 40. Gabriel, by that point in time, eons old, let's assume.
Well, this is an advantage to Joseph Smith, who was able to, you know, produce his own modern Bible fanfic at a much, much younger age.
That's right.
So, you know, good job. I mean.
But he was also writing it down, right? Wasn't.
He was reciting it to others who would write it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So there is something about this recitation of inspiration, and then you have your scribes.
There's a close parallel that a Mormon audience would recognize.
Is that something that happens within the...
I don't know if the comparisons to Muhammad are often made largely for cultural reasons. Like, not everything about Muhammad might be a big hit in the Mountain West politically. Mm-hmm. But the idea that this untutored person might just start reciting new scripture, absolutely.
Yeah, it speaks to its veracity.
Yeah. And it's used, and that's how it's used. It's like, how could this unschooled person, just, you know, barely literate, produce this kind of thinking?
Well, the dates here end up being very important to the story. The revelation began in 610, and it, by all accounts, continued until Muhammad died in 632. So there was 20 plus years of revelation happening.
I see. The Quran is not.
It didn't all happen in an afternoon.
Would a Muslim be okay with that idea that the Quran appeared to Muhammad over the course of his life and not just in one weekend in a cave?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean the chapters. You know, it's an unfolding story, mm-hmm. and this is the canonical story. But these dates are very important because in the 600 years between the. Between the life of Christ and the life of Muhammad, technology of newspapers and history and just that proximity, the additional proximity we have to
Muhammad, a little closer to us, yeah.
There's a lot more record of the early days of Islam than there are of the life of Christ.
There's documentary evidence.
There's a lot of, I mean, that whole...
Because more than zero, basically. There's hardly anything of Jesus' time.
Exactly. And the whole movement of scholarship about Jesus' life, part of it is kind of... part of the curiosity is like, is Jesus even actual?
Yeah,
right?
It's centuries later, people are saying, well, of course, here's what he told me, or you know, here's what I heard.
I mean, having gone to Jerusalem and gone through the archaeological dig there in the city of David, the number of actual sort of inscriptions or written documents that actually, like on the site, mm-hmm. that actually back up really a lot of the biblical stories, pretty scant on the ground. You're reading a lot into it from other source documents that were written in other places, you know, like, oh, there was this style of architecture we found in Damascus in the same hole that we also found this coin that references David. And since that style of architecture is also present here, literally at the foot of his castle, or what would you say, castle? Temple.
Sure.
That's the proof. You know, there's not a ton of written record.
It's a problem for Judaism. I think there's not even any documentary evidence of slavery in Egypt. Like, this is a pretty foundational tradition to the Jewish people that, you know, cannot be found elsewhere in the historical record.
Yeah, this so. Happens a lot. And within Islam, part of why there's more documentation is that Islam emanated out from Arabia in the form of conquering other countries and Islamifying them really quickly after the death of Muhammad, right? Within 100 years, Islam had spread widely, long enough that—
It's a meme.
I mean, so quickly, rather, that there were, during the actual writing and codification of the Quran, it was possible to go and consult with people who had known Muhammad. And the group of men who had followed him, mm-hmm. and had initially learned the Quran by heart from him, still lived at the time that they were compiling the definitive text.
Whereas at the time Rome is Christianized, it's hundreds of years later.
Hundreds of years later. And the, you know, the Council of Nicaea.
As we've covered,
right? They're trying to compile a book out of, by that point in time, 100 different traditions and churches.
And even basic theologies are going questioned because there's schisms between different warring schools of thought. But not so much of this Kremlinology necessary for Islam, because you can go right back to somebody who, yes, here's what Muhammad told me.
Yeah, one of Muhammad's first, earliest followers was a shepherd boy by the name of Abd Allah ibn Mas'ud.
Okay.
And he had the experience of running into Muhammad and Abu Bakr out in a field, and those two said, hey, can we get some milk from your sheep? And Abd Allah said, well, I can't steal milk from my employer. And Muhammad said, well, will you hand me one of the ewes that has not been mated, like a virgin lady sheep?
Okay.
And then he stroked her udder, and milk poured forth.
Miraculously.
Miraculously.
Because she shouldn't have had milk.
And that was the thing that made Abd Allah go, you know, I'm joining you. Tell me more about this magic story.
I mean, religious conversion seems easier back then, quite honestly. I've been a Mormon missionary, and
did you ever do this with the sheep?
I don't think the udder trick would have worked.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's harder
in Spain in the early 90s.
Well, now there's video games and stuff. I know. It's harder to impress people.
Coca-Cola and MTV.
And he was one of the first, Abd Allah was one of the first people that memorized whole sections of the Quran as recited by Muhammad himself. He was the first person to have memorized over 70 surahs, and became like a foundational member of the church. Another issue in that early spread of Islam was that there were a lot of different dialects in Arabic. And so as the story got passed around, initially, again, not written, but as an oral tradition, a lot of these different dialects had different synonyms for words, just different ways of saying the same thing.
Different vocabulary.
And so in those early years, all of that was acceptable within that initial community. Yeah, of course, you're going to say it this way. You have a different word for virgin sheep than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not, in the community in Muhammad's time, an extremely rigid sense of like, it's only said this way, it's only this.
They didn't have that emphasis on literality that a modern Muslim might have.
But what's curious is that the whole of the text really is constant, even through all of these different sort of early kind of interpretations. It's not interpretation of the scripture itself.
So there's no game of telephone happening where, you know, it gets further and further abroad, right, as, you know, the further you get from Mecca and Medina.
Exactly.
Like the.
So we are supposed to marry our sisters or we're not? What is that? You know, like, no, there's none of that. It's really solid. But we're getting into now what we would call in the Western way, this kind of search for the historical Muhammad, search for the historical Islam.
Yeah.
And that is a tradition that that we think now of being kind of alien to Islamic scholarship. But in fact, it's not. It in the 19th century, a lot of the exchange between the Arab world and the European world, we think of as being kind of a unidirectional colonialist, like overwhelming.
Right, because that's how the 20th century went.
But in fact, there was a lot of cross-pollinization, and a lot of Arab scholars visited the capitals of the West, mm-hmm, and experienced both Enlightenment thinking and also industrial modernization, and were very impressed by it and thought, this is not incompatible with Islam.
Do we need a sign for that?
Oh, where is our sign?
Where's our not compatible with Islam
this
sign?
This is compatible with Islam. And a lot of those Arab and Islamic scholars that visited Europe had that same kind of modernist approach, saying, in effect, if the Quran is true, then it has to be compatible with the, not just the steam engine, but with democracy and with emancipation and with these modern ideas.
And before the Enlightenment, you know, there were, I don't know how this ties in with the fact that, you know, there would have been centuries where in a lot of scientific fields, the Islamic world would have been ahead of the European world, right?
But there was, you know, there within Islam, there was not, say, for instance, a flat earth theory, right, that science then upended. You know, it was because Islam was more modern, but also in the Arabic world that was, or in the Ottoman world especially, you know, science was held in such high regard.
Yep.
There was not this kind of conservative dominance where the majority of thinking was around
was fundamentalist.
Yeah,
right?
The inerrancy of the text. And so this modernist movement in the 19th century was very open to the idea of reading the Quran in contemporary terms, maintaining it as a fundamental document, as the fundamental true guide to life and government, and then finding within it an understanding that would allow for adopting
modernity. Yeah.
Yeah. Modernity, not just the technology, but also the social liberalism and the democratic liberalism that seemed to those scholars to be kind of like, oh, well, this actually does feel like a closer approximation of how humans should live and interact.
I mean, if they're anything like most scholars, it's case by case based on what appeals to them, you know? Right. If you're a scholar who's like, yeah, no, women actually should be treated like that, then you look for the support for that in the Quran.
Exactly.
And there's probably some scholar at a different school who's saying, no.
Well, and I think London in 1830 must have been, you know, a pretty dynamic and impressive place.
Yeah.
And and to be excited by all those new machines and all that new stuff.
And steampunk version of the Quran. Yeah, maybe.
Like let's go read this a different way, right? And see how this goes. But that Islamic modernism kind of continued as a major movement until the 20th century, and the fall and really cultivated within the Ottoman Empire, which was also trying to be not trying was successfully kind of a modern empire of its own,
straddling both worlds,
and really seeking a kind of, you know, the modern Muslim worldview.
Yeah.
But the fall of the Ottoman Empire after World War I and the real clash at that point in time between the Arab world and the kind of worst influence and after effect of colonial Europeanism.
Is that what produced kind of the revanchist pullback to the more fundamentalist Islam we see today?
Yeah, there was a kind of misidentification of Islamic modernism with secular nationalism.
Uh-huh.
And the idea of modernity as being a secular movement and one that was imitating Westernism and therefore bringing Western decadence.
So you get retrenchment back to...
Exactly. And a lot of that was happening in Egypt, the idea that no, we need to retain the Quran as the center of our culture, and it needs to be an inerrant document, right?
You need to kick out anything that even looks Western, because obviously that's something brought by infidels.
So the Quran that most Muslims know is the most widely dispersed Quran until very recently was the Cairo edition of 1924. And there are a lot of...
You can only go back to 1924 to get this text.
Well, this text is just a... It isn't something where it's eliminated Apocrypha and it's brought in other, you know, simplified or anything. It's just... it's just the sort of basic text still derived from those original Qurans, but with a standardized set of sort of diacritical pronunciations and so forth. It's not like a King James version relative to a Latin Vulgate.
Because there aren't multiple versions, really. Like a Muslim would not have the sense that there's a bunch of different options here when it comes to the Quran.
Well, so what happened in the very earliest days, the first Quran was written down, you know, scribes were starting to write down
these oral
the teachings
traditions
of Muhammad, even in his own lifetime.
Huh.
And this began the kind of...
I assume those don't survive, but there's a chain of it?
There's a chain of it, and a lot of it, a lot of those early transcriptions, even taken from different... sources, different people listening to Muhammad, they're all extremely consistent with one another, but with a certain amount of variation for synonyms, for pronunciation, but there's not apocrypha, right? There's not stuff that one person has that's radically different from another.
Yeah.
And Muhammad, even in his own lifetime, said that that his great gift to the world was his family and his book. So it was already being compiled as a book.
As a book. He thought of it as a book and not just, I'm saying a bunch of stuff. Let's have a religion of that.
But the standard codex of the Quran was sort of written down and codified by Uthman ibn Affan, or as he's known sort of in the Turkish world, Osman. And he was Muhammad's second cousin and son-in-law.
Oh, he's a contemporary of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm. And he was the third caliph. And he said, we need to get all of these different versions together and put it all together in one book. And unlike the Council of Nicaea, this was within a couple of decades of the death of Muhammad. And they all knew him. And so he was only collecting versions of it from first sources, people that had written down from listening to Muhammad himself, brought it all together, all remarkably consistent, and just compiled it and squared it away, right? Here's how it's going to be spelled. Here's what between these two synonyms, this is the one we're going to choose.
This is what you're saying. It's like 30 years after Muhammad dies or
yeah,
something?
Not even. Yeah.
So it's really like, years. It's really like me going back and looking at Nirvana lyrics, right? Mm-hmm. We're now 30 years after the death of the person involved. So it does feel recent, and it's not like the Christian synthesis of the Bible.
Extremely recent. And especially like he was not considering texts that had gone through even a second chain of telephone.
Yeah. Or could be speculative fan fiction or apocrypha, right? These are all, the chain of authority is clear on all of them.
Well, and what he did, what Uthman did to really drop the ball on this was having standardized the Quran by 1652, he ordered all other versions of it burned.
That'll do it.
Exactly. And so throughout the...
I'm an author and I've never thought of this. What an amazing move.
I mean, this is not the Walt Whitman model of keep writing it over and over until you die.
I have one draft and I'm going to burn every other book in the field.
So at that moment, there was this Uthmanic codex, the definitive and unerring book. And it was not, you know, presented as like, this is exactly as it was communicated to Muhammad. Because, you know, Allah never appeared to Muhammad. It was always Gabriel, and the inspiration would hit Muhammad, and he always claimed that it hit him like a ton of bricks. Like it was really uncomfortable every time. I don't know what Joseph Smith says about it, but apparently revelation is a drag in terms of like the ouch of it.
Yeah, just the psychic market leaves.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah, I think many people who with religious experience have said that, including Joseph Smith.
Yeah, well, and me too. I mean, I feel it every time I get a profound revelation.
I assume that's why a lot of people avoid religion. It's a lot easier not to have contact with the divine.
And it's why we often take people who have had great religious experiences and burn them at the stake. Or throw them in a hole because they don't seem well. So now we're going to skip ahead to 1972. And in 1972, in the great state of Yemen, there is in the city of Sana'a a great mosque. And this is a very old mosque, a mosque that dates to really Muhammad's time. A lot of the scholarship around it suggests that Muhammad himself ordered it built. It was built around the time of his death, and it was the first big mosque built outside of Mecca and Medina.
Oh, really?
And Yemen was a place where Islam was being disseminated to the wider world. You know, it had that place there, that location on the Horn of Arabia. It would have had access to the Red Sea and Africa beyond, and was, you know, this was a major trading crossroads. In 72, they were restoring the plaster in the attic of the Great Mosque and knocked down a wall, and behind it they found, very akin to the Dead Sea Scrolls, thousands of manuscripts. Over 12,000 fragments.
Wow.
Of different kinds of parchment and...
So I'm not picturing scrolls. Are they flat kind of vellum?
Yeah, they are vellum. They're folios, but of a lot of different kinds of stuff. Not just Quranic texts, but Arabic writing on a lot of different topics. All written in what would have been a kind of like a pre-Islamic or contemporary with the era of Muhammad kind of script that was a little bit a little bit different than what became the sort of standard Arabic script. And among these were a very early text of the Quran, and one that conforms very closely to the Uthmanic text.
It can't go back that far, right?
It
how old is this?
It can.
Oh, it's like it's literally from the 7th century.
The writing of this Quran, yes, conformed to a kind of late 7th, early 8th century, very early Uthmanic standard. And it had, you know, it had just enough variation kind of, with these early texts, you know, they're all being written by scribes on very expensive vellum. And you have to expect that there are some scribal inconsistencies, you know, they don't usually like write the wrong word and then scratch it out. But there is, you know, there's enough scribal variation, but it is extremely close, if not dead on, the Uthmanic standard. The workman that found all this vellum in the walls said, oh, you know, just like the Dead Sea Scrolls shepherds who used it as firewood, the Dead Sea Scrolls as firewood or fire starter, until somebody said, you know, I bet people would pay for that.
Oh, is that right? Or some of the Dead Sea Scrolls lost because it was like beautiful.
Yeah.
We're a desert people, something to burn.
Yeah. They didn't recognize its value right away. And then when they did recognize it, they just took it to the local market and tried to sell them piecemeal to people who were like, oh, I'm also trying to start a fire.
I mean, hey, they found them.
That's slightly dismissive.
Yeah. It sounds a little anti-shepherd.
I'm a little anti-shepherd here. I'm also anti-workman because these guys stuffed all of this vellum
in their pants,
20 potato sacks, and left them sitting on the stair. And they were only discovered kind of by they were recognized as important by the president of the Yemeni Antiquities Authority, a man by the name of Qadi al-Aqwa, who said, hey, these actually are significant.
The contractors just left them sitting in. They could easily have been thrown away.
Easily thrown away or used as fire starter or stolen.
We got really lucky.
But they were just like, just put them in these. I mean, I'm just curious where they got 20 potato sacks, frankly. Because it seems like a lot of potato sacks to have lying around in a
construction site.
In a construction site. There ended up being over 82 folios worth of almost half the Quran is contained in these. And al-Aqwa reached out to the global community and said, hey, this is important and we don't have the resources to properly study these. Can we get a Western partner that will help us make sense of what we found? And only in 1980 did some archaeologists in West Germany say, yeah, this seems like a good thing to go after, to try and figure, you know, to document this and translate it and see all what's going on. And in the course of investigating it, they realized that this Uthmanic document was actually a palimpsest, which is, at a time when vellum was extremely expensive,
cow leather, calf leather.
In this case, it would have been sheep skin. Those documents would, or those that vellum would often get reused, and a lot of what we have of ancient Greek writing, a lot of the writings that we actually know of, and are continuing to discover that survived the burning of the Library of Alexandria, or, you know, survived the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. we know of because we are able then to use modern technology to detect it underneath later writing.
So it got erased somehow? What is the tech to erase writing off of vellum?
Vellum is actually pretty stable, and they actually scrape it. You just scrape the surface of it.
And so you're doing the private detective thing with the side of a pencil and the on the pad on the guy's desk, and you get an address or whatever?
What happens is the ink that they used in ye olden times had a lot of iron in it. And over time, that iron oxidizes and you and the writing reappears. So, like, there are writings of Cicero that we only have because someone scraped it off of a parchment and then, you know, and then Augustine wrote over the top of it in Latin, and now we can, using photometric X-ray technology and science, we now are able to find this earlier writing. Well, this Quran had underneath it an earlier Quran.
Oh, and so they just reused the, it's not like somebody went through and did notes on that Quran and made a new draft. It's straight up, let's erase the old Quran and we'll just use this again, and it happened to be for another Quran.
Somebody did go through it and leave notes on it, and then they scraped it off and wrote the Uthmanic Quran over the top.
You know, I always say palimpsest, and you said palimpsest, but guess what? Both in the dictionary.
There you go. Palimpsest and palimpsest.
Teach the controversy. I'm a palimpsest guy. John, Mr. Palimpsest, we call him.
I'm sure there are lots of people that when I said palimpsest were tearing their hair out, all of the volemic scholars that listen to our show, and then you come in and save my bacon.
Palimpsest does seem like it's a... Maybe it's a sexual impropriety.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to ever be accused of...
You're doing it wrong. That is not how you do it. Palimpsest.
That is not the palimpsest.
Stop it immediately. We will burn you at the stake. Well, so the revelation that that there was this earlier Quran underneath the definitive Quran...
Oh, yeah. Is this theologically problematic?
Well, so these documents were taken to the National Museum by Al-Aqwa. And in the National Museum of Yemen, he noticed that every time he went to see the stack of documents that there were fewer of them. And they were being kind of pilfered by like local officials. And some of them actually were sold at auction at Sotheby's as recently as 2008. So the folio is kind of split up and kind of floating around. But that vellum was dated to, using carbon dating, the vellum was actually dated to the lifetime of Muhammad or slightly after.
Really?
Those sheeps lived between 578 and 669. So that's a pretty wide range, but it is conceivable that this was written either during or shortly after the lifetime of Muhammad. For a long time, I think this was regarded as the earliest version of the Quran. There's another Quran that's at a university in Birmingham, England, that in the style of our time is called the Birmingham Quran instead of, you know, whatever else. And it's the result of kind of this chain of custody that we kind of can't trace all the way back. There was a fire in Damascus in 1860, whatever. And that, the documents went there from there to Constantinople and then onward to Birmingham, and only discovered by a scholar recently. And the radiocarbon dating of that text, which is Uthmanic.
Well, it's the same as the text he standardized. That's what
this is, the standardized text. That is radiocarbon dated slightly earlier, from 568 to 645. So, you know, I mean, within that range.
And that's Muhammad's whole lifespan.
Well, and a little beyond, yeah. But within that range, they could be identical.
Yeah.
They could have been written from sheep that knew each other.
It's not clear which is older.
But within the community...
Can you tell if the sheep are virgins?
I don't think from the skin. Well, it's been scraped so many times.
Yeah, all the estrogen's gone.
So a lot of this, the excitement around this discovery of this earlier pre-Uthmanic and non-canonical text... That excitement went like around the world because it suggested a kind of historical Muhammad, historical Islam scholarship that we don't think of as being a part of contemporary Islam, right? It's heretical within that tradition because there's only one text of the Quran, and it is and it's direct from God. This is the kind of Western interpretation of it, and also the interpretation within Islam as promulgated by the Islamic Brotherhood movement post 1925 Egypt, a return to very traditional non-modernist world of interpreting this document.
Yeah.
And so particularly among Western scholars, it was very exciting. And there was the Yemeni people, the Yemenis, were very open to people studying these documents. There was a little bit of kerfuffle around sort of the way that things were being translated and talked about. And a German scholar suggested in an interview that the Yemenis were reluctant to have this story told because of what it represented in terms of undermining the canon.
It's some kind of secular threat to Islam.
And that story went worldwide in Western media as like, oh, check it out.
Islam under threat.
That's right. The Islamic authorities don't want
circling the wagon.
The historical Muhammad known. That was a kind of sensationalist headline.
Yeah.
And so that became the Sana'a manuscript became a like a kind of divisive artifact that was pitting these two traditions against one another.
But among Islamic scholars, that wasn't really the case, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of, this is the only, like, even half Quran that differs significantly from the Uthmanic one. The thing is, it doesn't really differ that much.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Like, what kind of changes are we talking about?
Hardly any. It's differences of, there are a couple of things that are in a different order. There are quite a few words that are where it's a synonym for the word that's used.
A vocabulary difference.
So it's in a way
slight rewordings.
It's a dialectical version that's not that's not the one that Uthman codified. It should have been burned during the big purge, and instead, apparently, ended up in the wall of the mosque.
I mean, this is exactly what Uthman was worried about, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what's
Uthman
interesting
was right.
Is that Abd Allah, the shepherd boy, who was one of Muhammad's original, maybe the first to really learn the Quran by heart, mm-hmm. When Uthman was burning all the other Quran, he refused to surrender his version. He was like, I'm the one that learned it in the first place.
This is my OG copy.
Yeah, this is me.
You're not taking my memorabilia.
And so he was this was a big controversy even in that time. But what's astonishing is that the story of the Sana'a manuscript went out throughout Western media with this kind of sensationalism around it. Like, here's a Quran that throws the whole story into question.
I mean, even with Christianity, people love those National Geographic covers about, could this be Noah's Ark? The historical Mary, like they know this stuff sells in the heartland. And I can only imagine how that dovetails with America's current thinking about Islam.
Well, and because the Birmingham Codex is not a palimpsest, so it's on this old vellum. Yeah. And there's, within the scholars, they're always like, well, vellum was really expensive, so it's not like it was just laying around. Like, the fact that this dates to then, it was probably used immediately because, I mean, the number of sheeps it took to do a whole Quran. It's an entire flock of sheep. Like, so many.
That's what I think of when I look at a flock of sheep. I'm like, how many Quran is that?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
that's a lot of sheep. Is that like three Quran?
Like, vellum's a big deal.
It's like this, what's the thing? The snood? What's the stupid MIT bridge?
Smoot.
Smoot, yeah.
How many smoots is
it? How many smoots in the Quran?
Equals one Quran.
So I see what you're saying. The question is like, could this be old vellum but the writing is actually 11th century or something.
And what's interesting about the Sanam Quran is that it is a palimpsest. So we have the Uthmanic one, and the suggestion is it had to have existed in its non-canonical state for long enough for people to then both comment, because there are some writings on it that seem to be in a different hand that are like a teacher.
Marginalia.
Yeah, that's like, this isn't how we say it. Enough that then and that would have been scraped off. And in that, probably that very moment where Uthman was saying, and here is the final version, they scraped the old one and put the new one on. Whereas the Birmingham one, there are, again, Western scholars that point to it because there's all this revisionism, anti-revisionism, people love to yell at each other in this community. And frankly, if you read the all the writing on it, it's so dry. It's so boring because it's only really being studied by people that are interested in cataloging vellum. Like there's so little readable writing on it and so much writing that is, it's almost Old Testament in its repetition of catalog numbers and insider text around interpreting documents rather than actually interpreting the writing.
It sounds like this is the kind of thing that would be an amazing, you know, it would be an amazing, it would shore up a lot of traditions this old were a document this close to literal and so close to the source to actually appear. But because of the peculiarities of different modern traditions in Islam, it seems like, you know, a near verbatim 7th century account of your religion is actually, you know, maybe trouble, right?
This is only controversial to someone who basically has been told,
beholden to every comma.
Yeah, that the Uthmanic version is direct from Muhammad.
God's will, yeah.
But the story, you know, it was translated through a admittedly small cast of people who had memorized it, and then very early codified. The Sanam manuscript actually is an incredible support of that story.
I was just thinking in a Christian tradition, if some version of the Bible showed up that close to the life of the principles involved and that close to our current text, it would be mind-blowing.
Yeah. And honestly, the debate now, it survives only among basically Germans and Scots who are arguing about this kind of revisionism. Mm-hmm. Amongst themselves, and it's no longer kind of the tip of the spear. But what's interesting to me is that the story that we have in the West that we forget all the time is that modernism and historical interpretation is not alien to Islamic intellectualism. And even a country as conservative as Yemen is not hostile to this story. It's really the people that are hostile to it are the ones that are reading the 1924 Cairo edition and thinking, you know, that this is the extreme teen Bible and it's the unerring word of God.
And non-believers, infidels who are reading headlines in Der Spiegel and are like, oh, ho, ho, what new dust up today? It's, you know, it's new atheists. Again, it all comes back to
You know what? And my next show is going to be on the new atheists.
We can blame them for everything. And that concludes the Sanaa Manuscript, entry 1100.2T0316, certificate number 24503, in the omnibus The palimpsest or palimpsest of our day is social media, because you can delete posts and tweets and then put them back without the typo. There's version. Facebook has version marking, right? Yeah, Facebook's a palimpsest.
Yeah, right. So keeps getting scraped.
I think maybe Reddit, you can't see the changes when somebody edits their post. But we were products of our time, and you can see our social media palimpsest at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. We received physical items in the mail. Send us, send John, you lost your Quran. Send John a replacement Quran to.
Yeah.
You know, because he's very curious, you know, ever since that year in prison.
I've probably thumbed through it, not as much as I've thumbed through the Old Testament, but as much as I've thumbed through the New Testament.
My sense is that it has less narrative, just to a casual mm-hmm. reader. You know, you can open the Bible and be like, okay, where's the bit about Noah? Where's the bit about the prodigal son? Whereas in the Quran, maybe there's less of that, there's less of a foothold to a new reader.
Yeah, which makes it...
No characters.
You know, even more fun to just dive right in the middle. You're not like, oh, I missed all the lead up to this.
I don't know what you skipped season two of Succession. You have no regrets.
I did. I don't look back. What happened? The kids were all douchey and dad was a jerk?
I'm sure there was a lot of intrigue. The kids probably formed various allegiances and then betrayed them.
Yeah, right. I mean, I started again because my daughter's mother/partner was like, we have to, everybody's talking about this. We need to watch it. And I was like, all right, let's start in season three.
I noticed. Go ahead.
I know. I don't feel like I've missed a thing.
It's a funny thing about prestige TV, which is supposed to be this amazing literary form, but they're really beholden to all the problems of serialization. You know, we're going to do, I remember my wife and I joking on Mad Men that like it became like three or four times the show would just reboot. Okay, we're going to form a new agency.
Yeah.
And it started to happen three or four times. Okay, let's form a new agency. And you started to realize, oh, I could have skipped. This season both starts and ends with them forming a new agency. I probably could have skipped all this.
Yeah, but the problem is that, you know, then you have the Lost problem, which is that in the end, there is no conclusion. It's like, oh, and it was all a dream, the end. And you're like, well, I guess I wasn't watching this to get to the end because the end right. was garbage. So I was just watching this to pass the time.
It turns out like a 40-hour piece of entertainment, you can't think of as a cohesive whole the way you would a movie or even a novel.
Yeah.
You know, it really is just about the journey and what you were thinking at every step along the way.
Yeah.
Not once you can look back and see it as a whole.
I mean, basically it is an alternative to playing Scrabble or Boggle. Like, what are we going to do tonight? Let's play Scrabble.
Do you see the Quran as an alternative to playing Boggle?
No, but definitely
a lot of scholars sharpening their quills here.
Definitely, like the New York Times Bumblebee game is basically just Boggle, right? It's almost exactly Boggle.
Yeah, I mean, it's like trying to keep up with the Atlantic or whatever, except they're not going to send you a new Quran every week.
Yeah, but at least with the Atlantic, you carry something with you. With Lost, all you carry with you is a sense of betrayal.
Yeah, that is correct.
So although in the Atlantic, if they talked about the Sanaa document and you were like, yeah, and then later you realize, oh, I was duped.
What if we treated every art form like this? Like it's getting to the ending, you know, 40 years of Jeopardy or 60 years of the Today Show or 90 years of National Geographic. You're like, well, so far, you know, let's hope they stick the landing. I can't wait to see what happens in the last issue of National Geographic. It better sum up all these. It better tie together all these plot threads. Mr. Echo better come back.
Yeah, I mean, if you really love like Rembrandt's The Night Watch, and then you realize, wait a minute, like what ended up happening to the Netherlands? Like none of this matters.
It would be funny to do that with a painter's oeuvre. Like, okay, well, I've got to see all these. I got to see all these Picassos in order.
Sunflowers again.
What was I even saying? Oh, yeah. Send John a Quran to Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Have you deleted many tweets?
No, I always delete tweets with a typo.
Oh, yeah. Right. I never would.
But the problem is everyone sees the wrong one, and then, you know, 30 seconds later, then they see the right one, and then you're playing spot the difference like you're at a... Like you're looking at a Denny's placemat.
I really cared about my tweets for a long time, so I never They had any with typos.
They were all exactly 140 characters.
They were really perfect. They were really perfect. But, you know, I had to delete a bunch of them. And now I feel like my, well, and then my Twitter got canceled. So it's like a palimpsest on top of a palimpsest.
You can't, nobody can write on it now, right?
Right. It's done.
When they shut down your Twitter, are your old tweets still there? Not readable?
I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know.
Future archaeologists will have to.
Yeah, the Library of Congress is going to have to determine that.
No, they got a librarian in charge of throwing away the printouts of people's tweets the second Elon closes their account. Email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Find your fellow futurelings on Facebook or Reddit and have a sense of community. Complain about the religious heresies in this or other entries. And the best way to support The Omnibus would be to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and become a supporter. The Patreon is maybe now in its third year, and a lot of the people who actually knew Muhammad, you know, they've maybe their fervor has dimmed somewhat.
No.
Many still donate, but by the numbers, and I've looked at the numbers, not all do. Right. And what we need is an influx of new blood, some new fundamentalists to rise up against this tide of casual freeloading secularism of people that don't get all the cool omnibus perks.
But also all those original OG people need to get right with God.
By what? Doubling their contribution?
Well, I mean, or the ones that have, you know, the ones that have dropped off to go support some, you know, some dollop podcast.
That's the question. Should our missionary effort be to try to bring back to the lost sheep of the fold? Or should we be, you know, sending our missionaries to the Sentinel Islands to try to find new uncontacted Patreon non-subscribers?
Yeah, exactly. The Hasidim in Brooklyn are trying to grab hipsters off the street and turn them back into observant Jews, whereas the Mormons are like, no, we're going to Iceland and we're going to find
some people who have never heard of Mormons.
Yeah,
that might be a wise play.
All the elves that are living in caves, we're going to convert them. So which are we? We're both, right? I'm the Hasidim on the street saying, listen, hipsters,
yeah,
get back to first principles.
You missed out on some great Addenda shows, yep, while your donation lapsed.
And you are saying,
hey, tens of thousands of people are listening now who have heard us plug the Patreon and have never thought, I've got $5 a month.
Yeah, that's me. I'm a young person who wants a new gospel, something fresh.
This is the Addenda is the teen, is the hip teen Bible, whatever it's called, the extreme teen Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Omnibus, but with more slang.
Come one, come all. And we're also, we're recording a Addenda right after this. So.
It's true. The, let's see, this will come out in July, but we're about to record the June Addenda.
Yeah, so think about that for a second.
Weird time paradox is about to happen in this room.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.